Good evening, everybody. This is Dr. Patrick Cohn with Peak Performance Sports at peaksports.com. As you know, this two full days, like I said, mind-bending mental training strategies with some of the top sports psychology experts I could get in. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Ken Revizza. He's conducted over 1,000 sports psychology programs worldwide. And Dr. Ken Revizza, I call him Ken, and he calls me Packy, so you'll probably, that's my nickname, so you'll probably be hearing Ken talk about Packy tonight. He's a professor of applied sports psychology at California State University at Fullerton. Ken was my mentor in the mid-'80s, mid to late 80s. He's the one that got me excited about sports psychology. I wouldn't be where I am today in the field of sports psychology without Ken. It's that simple. He's worked with some of the top athletes in the world, major leaguers, NFL teams, national champions, Olympic champions.
Stop
the list
it,
goes
Packy.
On
Stop
and on.
It enough. I put up with Packy for a year and a half. Unbelievable. Patrick,
unbelievable. And here we are. What is
here
it?
We
20
are.
Years later. 20 years later, we're here together.
Beautiful
and
what
you're
doing, Patrick. Getting the information out to people. It's great. Really
well,
proud of you, man. Really proud of you.
Well, I'm here because of you. You're the one that got me excited about all this, Ken. First, give us a little feel for your background in sports psychology. For those that aren't completely familiar with your work, I know you came from kind of peak experience, existential psychology, stress management, yoga. How did you get started, and where's your really your background from in this area?
Okay. Well, when I got started, there weren't graduate programs in sports psychology, so my doctorate was at USC, Southern Cal, and it was in sport philosophy, looking at questions like why does man play, what meaning do they find in movement, that type of stuff, and I loved it. And at the same time, when I was at USC, I started getting into yoga and some of the Eastern philosophy, and those two sort of blended together, and there was a great book called The Inner Game of Tennis by a guy named Tim Galway that came out at that time, and that really influenced me. And then next thing, I'm at Cal State Fullerton, and I'm teaching classes in stress management, like you said, sport philosophy, and I was teaching some hatha yoga classes, and the students were saying, hey, I'm using this stuff in performance with my athletics, and that just got me going. And from there, one thing led to another, started working with our gymnastics teams, and that led to baseball. In 84, the baseball team wins the national championship. Some of the pitchers say, hey, the stuff we did with Ken was helpful, and next thing I know, I go to the Angels, and I was with them for 16 years, working with their major league club, their minor leagues, and over that 16-year period of time, I experienced being sent to the minors, released, rehired, you know, went through that whole emotional roller coaster. And I've been fortunate, Packy, to learn from a lot of great athletes and great coaches.
Isn't it unique that the information that we glean from sports psychology and work with our athletes, isn't it interesting that that majority of it comes from great athletes and coaches themselves?
Yeah. I mean, I think the research background, having the research information, some of that is very good, but also you got to get in the trenches and you got to ask questions and talk with the athletes and talk with the coaches to find out the specifics of how do you put that theory into application, you know? Because I think part of what we do is we translate in sports psychology. We translate information, but we have to put it into a language that the athlete and coaches can latch onto, you know, and make it meaningful for them.
We hear so much today about things like the flow. You know, Dr. Csikszentmihalyi, who studied
great
flow.
Great pronunciation.
Yes, I've read enough of his stuff now, Ken.
Yeah.
But he's influenced us as well, coming from, you know, a performer's perspective.
Right.
And you hear a lot about the zone. What is your perspective about all these concepts that are thrown around, the flow, getting into the flow, the zone? Do you differentiate those? Are those the same type of concepts?
Well, it's interesting, Packy. When you were studying with me, my initial research when I was in graduate school was the study on the peak experience in sport. And at that time, there was no other literature on it, so it was great in terms of a doctoral dissertation. Didn't have a lot of literature to review. I just read the work of Abraham Maslow and took it and related it to sport and found that athletes have these incredible experiences when they're performing at these high levels. And from that point, I really spent a lot of time early in my work in applied sports psych trying to get athletes into the zone, into the, you know, those feelings of total focus, presentness, relaxed concentration, the controlled intensity, the crystal clear thinking. And, man, I spent 10 years trying to do that back in. And then the stuff on flow came up from Dr. C and the zone. Well, where I'm at now, Packy, and I know we've talked about this a little bit, but I personally think the zone is overrated. I think we would get too consumed with trying to get people peaking, and I really have come to a point in my work where peak performance is not about being in the zone. It's about learning to compensate and adjust. It's about having a good, crappy day. It's about if you have 60%, use 100% of that 60, and stop worrying about being comfortable with what's going on. And I know this is hard for young people today because it's all about you got to be comfortable. And I'm really finding what peak performance and the zone is really about is it's about learning to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Interesting. You know, and I think I talk about the same thing, Ken, with some of the golfers that I work with, for example. When they're not having a good day, when they're off with their ball striking and they're struggling a little bit, rather than get all wrapped up and upset about, oh, this is awful, I'm not hitting the ball well, I talk about, you know, let's keep it together and let's just focus on scoring, getting the ball in the hole. Let's play functionally. Even though you're uncomfortable, as you say, let's just get the job done. Let's get through it today and win ugly. Is that
right?
Kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think it's stop dwelling on what you don't have and focus on what you do have and get it done with what you do have. That's the beautiful thing about Tiger. Whenever he talks about his game, first thing he talks about is whether he had his A, B, C, or D game. And then he bases his play off the game he had. And I think we need to do that because athletes, I've been around baseball, man, they're down the batting cages looking for their swing. It's like Peter Pan looking for his shadow, man. They're frantic. Where's my swing? And something I challenge them with is I go, are you that crappy that you got to have your A swing to get it done? You know, and really question them on that because I think it's really that phrase, and I got it from Lou Piniella, the manager with the Cubs, and that is you got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Embrace the adversity. I think so many athletes, they want everything to go well. And why do you think it's going to go well? If you want it to go well, play someone half your age. You know, if you're 16, play someone 8 years old, and you can dominate. And you can be in the zone. Great. Hey, if you're going to play tough competition, man, you're going to take blows. You got to absorb them, and you got to learn to bounce back and be resilient. That's where coming from with it.
Is it the perfectionist, the athlete that just wants everything to go a certain way, are the ones that have the most trouble with that concept?
I think they're always striving for perfection, but at the same time, the perfectionists very seldom get there because they're so hard on themselves. And I think what it does is give the perfectionist some breathing room, especially when you challenge them with the idea that, are you that bad? You need your A swing to get it done? Because
right.
You don't have to have your A swing to get it done. And it sort of gets the perfectionist to step back and sort of short-circuit that all-or-none thinking that they tend to get into. You know, Pac, one thing. I didn't tell you this, but this is important for the listeners, I think. About 3 years ago, I worked with our women's volleyball team at Cal State Fullerton, and I would say they happened to have been the best, worst team I had ever worked with in my life. I mean, basically in conference, I think we won one game. We had a lot of injuries early in the year. We weren't as talented for as many of the teams in our conference. And a lot of – and the gals on that team, they went out night after night, and they played to their potential night after night and kept getting losses. Now, to me, that's the utmost in terms of mental toughness, because we get this idea that if I do A, B, and C, I'm going to be a champion. Well, one thing I'm always telling athletes is this is not Disney World. The one who works the hardest doesn't always get the prize, and it's not fair. It's called athletics. It's a lot like life. The only thing you have is, did I give myself the best opportunity for success? And this team I'm talking about, Packy, they were so impressive because they kept coming out every night and battling and getting losses and stuck with it and held together as a team. Now, that is really special. And for the coaches out there, I know some of the coaches listening to your program, man, you've done some of your best coaching getting a team to 500. And sometimes you win a championship and you're glad to see the team leave when it's done. And it's one thing I think when we work in this area that I'm totally convinced of, it's all about the process. The end results are going to take care of themselves. I mean, you don't have control of that. It's just critical. How to get that in, Packy?
Okay, and I made a mistake, Ken. Thank you for that story. It's 5-star. If you have a question for Ken during the talk, it's 5-star. We'll take some questions as we're going along, too. Sorry about that error.
You better compensate and adjust, Packy. Let it go, man. Flush it.
I'm letting it go.
Next question, Pack.
I'm letting it go, Ken.
All right, man.
Well, you know, you talk about how it's overrated, you know, and I find that it's the athlete that has the most strict expectations. Ken, recently in my career, I've been focusing a lot about expectations. And, you know, coaches and athletes have trouble with it when I start talking about expectations. But to me, all expectations are typically too rigid. They focus too much on results, and they become very judgmental. When I talked to University of Buffalo coaches last week, they invited me in to talk to 62 Division I coaches. And when I start talking about expectations, they're just turning their head going, well, you know, we have a different version of what expectations are. But from my perspective, I see athletes, they set these rigid, strict rules, and that's what I'm defining as expectations upon themselves, and then they can adjust. When things don't go well or things don't go up to expectations, they have trouble adjusting. They either get frustrated or they lose confidence or they dwell. I don't know if that's, you know, kind of a pattern that you're seeing as well.
I think the expectation that you're talking about is when you get preoccupied with the results. You know, expectations are in the future. Where you have control is in the here and now. Are the expectations there? Definitely. Every coach knows, hey, the goal of sport is to win. There's nothing wrong with that. But then the issue is it's not focusing on that, but it's focusing on what it takes to get there. I mean, this is the thing I love about John Wooden when you read his stuff, the great UCLA coach.
Right.
I spent 3 years at University of Nebraska with Tom Osborne, and he never talked about winning, but he talked about what do we need to do to win. And, yeah, we have expectations, but the expectations are on the short-term goals that if we achieve those, look at what might happen. No guarantees. Might happen. Give yourself the best chance for success. So when the expectations come into play, they can motivate us, but we need to focus on what it's going to take to achieve those expectations.
You know, 20 years later, I'm still quoting you.
Uh-oh.
And one of the quotes that I use all the time, and I give you credit for it, is you have to be in control of yourself before you can control your performance. And that's something that I always remember you talking about in, you know, some of the classes and with the teams and me following you around and doing your stuff with the teams.
Yeah.
What does that mean, and how does an athlete become in control of themselves?
Well, I think that's the foundation of the mental game, Packy, is you've got to take basically responsibility for what's happening. And what I mean by that is responsibility in the sense that you don't have control of what goes on around you. Mm-hmm. You only have control of how you choose to respond to it. And that's the basic foundation for me where I start from, because there's so much that an athlete doesn't have control of. They don't have control of the coaches, don't have control of playing time, don't have control of weather, don't have control of opponent, don't have control of teammates. I mean, there isn't much you got control of. All you got control of is yourself. You got control of your attitude, and you got control of your effort. Okay, I'm at Cal State Fullerton with our baseball and softball team, strong programs. There are athletes that come in there, and for the first time in their life, they're riding the bench. They've never been on the bench. Hey, they got to deal with it. It's their attitude in dealing with that position that they're now in, that role, and being, as I tell them, hey, you got to become one of the best bench players that's ever played at Cal State Fullerton and embrace the role. Are you happy with it? No. But that's the idea that how you deal with it, your attitude, that's your decision. Now, when I can take responsibility and focus on the things I got control of, then the next thing that follows is I've got to be in control of myself before I control my performance, because self-control leads to body control, which leads to skill control. And very often what we're doing is we're breaking down the mechanics of the thing. And sometimes it's not mechanics. Sometimes what it is it's a tight buttocks. I was introduced at the Atlanta Olympics to a tendon in the human body. We call it the sphincter cranial tendon. I mean, it
runs. Careful, Ken. Careful, Ken. Where you go here?
We got to be careful here. But it's that tendon that runs from the buttocks up around the cranium. Now, of course, it's imaginary, but you see some athletes, man, when they tighten up, the performance is going to break down. And very often what they have to do is get control of themselves. And, Packy, one thing I haven't changed in all my years of doing this, man, is a lot of it is real simple. It's about the breathing and getting the breath. But that sounds so simple, and how could it be so simple? Well, it's very simple, but it's very complex and very difficult to do when the garbage is hitting the fan.
Yes, yes. So are you talking about emotional control, physiological control? What type of self-control when you talk to your athletes?
Excellent question, Packy. One thing from my perspective is you can't break the person down into emotional, physical, cognitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all experience. I mean, what's going on in the body is going to affect the thoughts. What's going on in the thoughts and body are going to affect the emotions. I mean, it's all interconnected. But the issue is that at least I start looking when I'm starting to feel myself, like the tennis player who's going, I don't have a good backhand. Oh, God, here comes a backhand. Oh, God, I don't have a good backhand. I don't have a good forehand. Next thing you know, I can't play tennis. I should run cross country. I mean, they start spinning out of control. But if we can recognize it early that something isn't right, and that's where the awareness part comes in, that I'm able to recognize in terms of my emotional state, my thought process, my what's going on in my body, my arousal level, that I recognize, where am I at? I know, Packy, you know, a lot of the things you talk about the inverted you, and you have your people, you know, tuned into that, and I think that's important. But in relation to that, I view athletic performance like driving a car. And when you come to a signal light, if the light's green, you go. If the light's yellow, you got to attend to the intersection, check the rearview mirror for a police officer, and then make your call. If the light's red, you got to stop. And this whole idea of self-control is recognizing your signal lights and where you're at in relation to your performance. For a young athlete, sometimes it takes the coach's expertise to help him or her understand their signal lights and get more of a feel for, if I keep doing that, this is going to happen, so that they can nip it in the bud before it gets out of control.
You make it sound so simple, but you know, from my perspective, Ken, when working with athletes and talking about staying in the present and staying under control, in that setting, talking with them, it sounds so simple to do, but what you and I know, the or at least from my perspective, the hardest thing that I in terms of the task that I do with athletes is trying to get them to apply the concepts to practice and competition on a daily basis. How do you bridge the gap between the conceptual ideas that you're talking about now and then actually helping the athletes do it while they're spinning out of control?
Well, I think what you've talked about, and Packy, as I'm talking, I hope I'm not blabbing too much here.
No.
Sort of, I'm talking, I'm going, wow, maybe I'm talking too much. Hold it, I lost the thought, Packy. Refresh me. Hit me again with it.
It's the application that's so difficult from my perspective.
Okay, so the application, you know, how do you do it? Well, the thing I believe in strongly, Packy, is it's got to be practice. Like if I'm talking to a group of athletes, let's say we're meeting in a classroom and I have 40 athletes sitting in the room. And as I'm talking, let's say someone comes in the room late to the meeting, walks up front and sits down. If everyone turns and looks at that person coming in, I just say, hey, stop. Stop. Ask the person who came in late to step outside, count to about 30, and then walk back in. And I tell the people, the athletes sitting in the room, I go, this time when he or she walks in, you stay focused on me because that's a distraction. This is what happens in the game. So now the person walks in, they stay focused on me, and they're practicing their ability to concentrate. It's one of the things, Packy, I'm doing all the time. Is getting athletes to practice the mental game on a daily basis in practice, also in class, when you're sitting in class and you're bored and you're drifting. Tell yourself for the next 30 seconds, I'm going to turn it around. I'm going to lock into what's happening right here, right now. So they're practicing getting back to the next possession, next play, next pitch. So it's a drill you're playing with. I don't know if that makes sense, Packy. Trying to
it's so critical just to work it in, what you're saying, into the daily practice so that it becomes almost
and
ritualistic.
Like, and like for the coaches on the phone, every once in a while, I mean, young people today grew up on Sesame Street. I mean, you're talking about a 20-second attention span. It's our culture. Mm-hmm. You got to talk in time bites. I mean, sometimes as a coach, you got to say, hey, I need 30 seconds, lock in, boom, make your point. And this is one thing when we, I mean, talking about practice, hopefully this is something we can do when we get together at the conference, Packy, is going to be, like, as coaches, when do you practice timeouts? When do you practice? You got 2 minutes. How do you convey the information in 2 minutes? How do you practice halftime? I mean, coaches I work with, man, we practice timeouts. We practice halftime. We practice making errors and coming back from errors and mistakes. Why? Because they happen in the game, and you're ready for them. Now, to get back to your point, and I got a little off the target there, but I get real excited. I think it's the coach in me that gets real excited when we start talking about practice, because good coaches salivate when you start talking about practice. And it's this idea of being present. It's what I said earlier, Packy. The breath sounds so... Oh, yeah, the breath. That's easy. No, it isn't easy. But I'll tell you what. It's basic and it's simple, but it's hard to do when the garbage is hitting the fan and it has to be practiced. If it gets very complex with what you're going to help you get back where you need to be, it's not going to get you there because it's too difficult to do it when the garbage is hitting the fan. And the garbage is going to hit the fan.
Let me take a question. I just noticed we had a question. I'm sorry if you've been raising your hand. Area code, let me see. It looks like 607. Do you have a question for Ken?
Yes, Ken. This is Bill Straub calling.
Hey, Bill. How are you, man?
Well, I'm still alive.
Hey, great to hear your voice, man.
You know, in speaking about practice, the question I had is, what are you advising coaches to do in terms of the application of mental training in the team situation? Are you advising coaches to have periodically have mental training sessions for the entire team? Are you saying to coaches, work individually with athletes, let athletes decide themselves whether they want to do mental training or not? What is your approach in this area?
Wow. Okay. Well, Bill, you've done some great work over the years. No question about that, man. And Bill Straub's got some of the best catching hands I've ever seen in my life. Those big hands. All right. I think in terms of your question, Bill, where I'm at today, I think when I first started, and I know when you first started, it would be like we'd go in as a consultant, talk to the team Wednesdays from 12 to 1. Maybe we'd talk about relaxation one week, concentration the next. And I do some of that now, but the talks are shorter in length. And where I really want to get the information across is I want to coach the coaches so that they can take the mental skills and incorporate them into task-relevant performance cues. So that it's, I remember at Cal State Fullerton, Judy Garman, our softball coach, I'd be in the wrestling room taking the gals through relaxation imagery, and she came up to me one day and she said, "You know, Ken, I'm tired of the girls in the wrestling room. I'm concerned 3-2 bases loaded. Can they be relaxed?" And that really motivated me to start taking the stuff and putting it into application on the practice field. And that's where the coaches have to be reinforcing and supporting it. And it's also where, as a consultant like myself, I have to speak that coach's language that Packy's talking about, and I know your work, Bill. We're talking about an educationally based program where we provide information, give the athlete skills to use that information, and then support them in refining and developing those skills. So hopefully that helps out, Bill. Because
all right, thank you very much, Ken.
Texas.
Thanks for the question, Bill.
Great hearing from you, Bill.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
Well, the other question that he brings up, Ken, is, I think, really critical about if you're a coach, do you force it on all of the athletes, or do you just work with the athletes? I remember you saying long time ago when I studied under you, half the athletes are going to be excited about it, a quarter of them are going to be sitting on the fence, and then there's going to be a quarter of the athletes in the room that just don't care or feel like they already have it.
Right.
And so do you force it, as a coach, do you force it on those athletes and make them join in, or do you only engage the athletes that really want it?
I think it's part of what you're doing. How can you keep it out? It's part of your coaching approach. I think good coaching involves the mental game. It's not like, well, now we're going to do mental game. Those of you that are into it can be into it. Those of you aren't that aren't. No, it's part of your coaching. And if you're talking the task-relevant performance keys, like the pressure situations like of the game, taking it one game at a time, taking it one play at a time, taking it one possession at a time, that isn't just mental game. That's performance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I've really now, in terms of like when I said one quarter, half, one quarter, I think that's more with a professional team. When I was talking about that, and I still think it's that way, but the professional team, it's all done individually. You're not working with the team as a whole. With a college or high school team, Packy, I think the kids, because the coaches have so much more influence, if the coach is buying into it and the coach is talking about it, then the players are going to get on board much more likely. Are there going to be some that are going to be resistant? Yeah. I think what's important for the coaches is to look at it from the perspective of not everyone is into skill execution with the same basic fundamentals, and you have to have individual differences within that. It's the same thing with the mental game. Some are more receptive than others. Some have some resistance. But another thing I've learned over the years, Packy, is, man, some of them that are resistant, you don't think they're into it, and then all of a sudden when the pressure situation comes, they have it to go to. So I'm really going to have the coach err on the side of it's part of the training, it's part of what we do, it's part of the program.